Hello, Peaks Chats listeners. This is Magellan. You are about to listen to Peaks Chats 6, which is the second half of our discussions for this week. The first being Peaks Chats 5, which was released on Sunday, and which featured our friends from Full Metal Analysts, Michelle and Arthur. Thank you again to the two of them for coming on the show. We hope you enjoyed that first half of our discussions, and we hope that you enjoyed this one as well. On with the show.
Peaks Chats, everyone. We are here and we are Magellan and Alan solo style, duo style. We're playing duos. We're talking about Realization Time. It's episode 6 of Twin Peaks season 1, or episode 7 if you include the pilot. Realization Time was directed by Caleb Deschanel, new director to the show. It was written by Harley Payton and it aired May 17th, 1990. Now, Magellan, can you tell me what happened in this episode, please?
In this episode, Audrey cons her way into working at the perfume counter where Laura worked and discovers that it's being used as a recruitment post for One-Eyed Jax. James, Donna, and Maddie plan to lure Jacoby away from his office. Alan, what'd you think of Realization Time?
Again, we're spinning those dang wheels. Funnily enough, it's kind of become a running joke on Full Metal Analyst that, like, even the really good middle-of-the-series episodes are still, like, just building towards something. It's an adaptation of a longer story. So it becomes a joke for them of saying, like, oh, this one kind of felt like it's building to something. And this one's definitely, this is like a pre-finale for sure. Uh-huh. And I liked a lot of the stuff that they're building towards, but also it just cannot be denied that the show is like, it doesn't matter. Like, a lot of this stuff just doesn't matter. and it's fun and enjoyable to, like, watch, and the performances are good. The parts are enjoyable and it's a good vibe, like we said, but it's becoming a show that I put on. Like, it's kind of, it might be a little bit hard to talk about because sometimes I'm just like, oh yeah, I enjoyed it, I had a good time, and that's how I felt about this one.
Yeah, I definitely was tuning out a lot more during the first episode. This one, I think, grabbed my attention more, and it actually got me in that sort of TV cliffhanger way where when the episode ended I was upset that it was over. So I think it functions pretty well as a penultimate episode to the season. It gets us, they've been sort of bridging to, like, we're going to go to One-Eyed Jax. We're eventually going to go to One-Eyed Jax. And then we finally get there in this episode. And we know that we're on the verge of something going wrong. So, you know, however you feel about a narrative being shaped like that, this episode gets us to the place where we know something big is going to happen in the season finale. Mm-hmm. So I just want to watch the season finale at this point.
Yeah. Like, this feels like exactly like you're saying, part one, and you just want the second one. If this was airing live, I would be like, no, and I'd be really mad. And now I am, because we watch these once a week.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember the thing. There was a shot before they go into One-Eyed Jax where the four guys line up. It's Cooper, Truman, Hawk, and, Doc Hayward. Uh-huh. That shot has been one of my rotating desktop wallpapers for a couple years now. Actually, since I watched this show originally.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's what we call, if you listen to our Patreon content and we watched an old film recently. What's it called? What the heck was that?
Knights of Cabiria.
Knights of Cabiria. Occasionally, yeah, you watch a Fellini movie and you're like, all right, this guy's just flexing. And occasionally here, it really just feels like the people directing, or Caleb Deschanel is just like, yo, check this out. What if I lined up the guys? Wouldn't it look sick? And you're like, yes, Caleb, it does look sick. Why did you do it, though? And it's, again, calling into question, how do we feel about the Bookhouse Boys? This, like, extrajudicial cool guy squad where they wear funny costumes and sneak into gambling dens. Do you like the Bookhouse Boys?
Well, I think I like them as individuals, right? And that's what makes it sort of fishy. Just to make it plot clear to folks listening, in case you didn't watch the episode itself. For various reasons, we learn, okay, for sure, we're going to go to One-Eyed Jack's. They find the rest of the poker chip at Jacques Renault's apartment, maybe?
Yes.
Somewhere like that. And they decide, the cops decide that they're going to go undercover and go gambling at One-Eyed Jack's to investigate that particular establishment. And,
but because it's outside of the state lines or whatever, it's on the line, the border, it becomes...
Yeah, it's in Canada, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like across the border in Canada. So Truman says, oh, that's out of our jurisdiction. And Cooper, and this is the telling moment that made me a little uncomfy, is he said, well, we can just use, you know, the sort of secret thing that we're not supposed to do, and then it'll be totally fine.
Hmm. Coop, I think you've officially become a cop. What methods can we use to do what we need to do, right?
And we see a side of Cooper in this whole thing that, yeah, makes me not super trusting of him, or sort of see him as, you know, the kind of classic like FBI man stereotype that I'm not necessarily into.
Yeah.
And we see him get really excited about the prospect of gambling. He says this.
It's $10,000 of the Bureau's money. Whenever I gamble with a company stake, I always like to bring back a 10 to 15% return. How much you want to start with? How about 300?
He like licks his thumbs. He's like, ooh, yeah, I'm going to gamble and make so much money.
And Ed is like grinning. He's like, ooh, yeah, we're going to gamble.
Yeah. They're broing out in this way. I'm like, I don't know if I'm along for this ride, Bookhouse Boys. But as individual characters, they're all, you know, Truman is a sweet boy. Ed's a sweet boy. Cooper's a sweet boy. They're all very, Hawk is a sweet boy. They're all very sweet. And so you root for them. But they're definitely in a moral gray area right now.
Mm-hmm.
And you could have a conversation about like, well, they have to do this in order to get to the bottom of things. I don't know. So it makes me uncomfortable, but I don't know that I have the sort of like leg to stand on to give them advice on how to conduct this particular investigation. But clearly what they're doing is a touch illegal.
Yeah, and they're reveling in it. Like, whether or not they're doing the illegal thing, they also are enjoying it, which is where I find myself not agreeing with them anymore. Yeah. But let's dig into this plot line a little more before we jump away from it, because I think this is like one of the highlights of this episode is the One-Eyed Jack stuff. Which is, I keep saying this, but Twin Peaks has really great, memorable set pieces. And when the One-Eyed Jack set is like that, it's bright, it's colorful, but it's also kind of creepy and seedy at the same time. And it's lit in a cool way. Like, I just enjoy being there. And I picked up on a new thing there this time. But before we get there, Cooper comes up to everybody else. Then the evening has started to fall on Twin Peaks. We're in the like lobby of the Great Northern or whatever. And he's got his whole suit and tie get up. And
his tuxedo.
His tuxedo, excuse, that's the word. I was like, what's the thing where it's a suit and tie and a whole thing? It's called a tuxedo. Jackie Chan's the tuxedo. Thank you. Look at the way the actor playing Truman looks at Cooper. He's so happy that his friend looks good. He's like, oh, Cooper, you look so spiffy. You look like a million bucks right here. He's like, Michael Onkin is like in love with this man. I think he's just, it's honestly like, you know, I make the joke, right? But I think Michael Onkin is just he's Canadian, right? And so he's just very like, he's nice and friendly to like a lot of people. He's from Vancouver.
Okay. Go ahead.
I like Harry Truman. I think he's lovable, even though he's also a cop and he can't be trusted. That's the fact of the matter.
Oh, okay. I thought.
And because he's Canadian, he's gay.
That's what I thought you were saying.
That's what I meant, but that's not what I was saying.
I actually kind of read it as a little apprehensive, him looking at Cooper and realizing, oh, my quaint friend can be a sort of James Bond guy when he needs to be.
Yeah. Is this before or after the gift? I think this is after. Yeah, the gift.
This is after. Yeah. They go to the diner. Harry and Cooper go to the diner seemingly just to go like scold Hank.
Yeah, not even to interrogate him, but to just be like, hey, Hank, I want you to know, fucking hate you. Anyways, bye.
Yeah, and then Shelley says, oh, do you guys want coffee? And Cooper,
oh my God,
gives this response. He was so, like, aroused by the thought of coffee. He's like, yes, coffee. Mm. And Truman says, no, we got
to
go.
We
and
then go.
Cooper says this.
Harry, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. Every day, once a day, give yourself a present. Don't plan it. Don't wait for it. Just let it happen. It could be a new shirt at the men's store, a catnap in your office chair, or two cups of good, hot, black coffee.
One of the most memorable quoted lines from Twin Peaks, by the way, because it's true. It's Cooper's, like, ideology in a nutshell.
Right, right.
Do things spur of the moment. Do things that make you happy. Be a sensualist. Feel things that are good for you and indulge a little bit. I like it a lot. And I like the way that Truman is like, oh, actually, we do have more time and we can actually have a cup of coffee here before we leave. Like, let's enjoy it for a bit. We got time. And it's the show also reminding us that, like, stop racing. Stop running so fast. Stop wanting to go to One Eye Jack so dang badly. We'll get there. We get half of it in this episode. And that's, like, in the last 15 minutes of the episode. So, you know, it's kind of the show reminding us that, like, okay, we're going to go and do the things you want to do, but we need to take a break sometimes. And it's good for our characters to be human and relatable by taking a minute, taking a sip.
Yeah, I mean, and you could sort of read it in that mindfulness way. I think you could also, there's a conversation to continue to have here that we started to talk about in the first half with Arthur and Michelle, just around, like, Cooper and indulgence and the way that he, like, indulges himself in little bits here and there.
Yeah.
And I don't know, there's kind of like a, I don't know what the word is, but it's asking me to acknowledge that Cooper is someone who, like, yearns and has desires and has, like, this very methodical way to have, like, short little bursts of, and now I'm going to indulge this particular desire. Now I'm going to have this little bit of pleasure. And there's something about, like, him having that level of control over it and that much purpose with it that, I don't know, it's just, not that there's necessarily anything wrong with that, but just to see that expressed in such clear terms in the context of the broader show, I don't, like, take it as a unambiguously nice moment because of the show that it's showing up in.
Yeah, it's one of the bummer. That's why it's weird that it's quoted so much, because in the context of the show, this is, and yeah, Cooper is somebody who wants to, like, sample all the things in life. And you can make a cool comparison and say that this is what the show is saying people in that era of time, in his age, want. I mean, Norma and Ed last episode basically are saying, we wish we could do things the way that Cooper does them. Or, like, we wish we could just have the things we want and, like, say we want them and do them, give ourselves presents, be with each other, love each other, all that stuff. And Cooper gets to have that. And he's an example. He's supposed to be, like, a likable, you know, beacon of, like, well, this is what happens when you just, like, let things happen and are very, like you said, this mindfulness, and you're just present, is you get to be the person who takes a minute for coffee. But, like you said, that's not the material reality, is that this is an FBI agent investigating a very gruesome and urgent and serious murder case. And it's pretty unprofessional also to be like, well, what about, so let's get a quick cup of Joe. And I think that's where the show, like, taking its sweet time also bothers me. To get back to the sort of framework of this back half of season 1/ what I remember about season 2 is, like, there's still a murder case going on. And it just seems like we don't even care anymore. Like, One Eye Jack is, like, a tertiary thing to Cooper right now. But, you know, this is a conversation that I think we're gonna come back to a few times, because, you know, the plot does move eventually, get back to the murder investigation this episode.
So the investigation leads us to One Eye Jack. Cooper's going with his bookhouse boys.
Right before we get there, sorry.
Oh, sure. Yep.
We have the Waldo stuff where they're getting ready in the evening to go. Right. You had a note about the recorder being voice activated.
Well, Cooper, it was surprising to me that technology existed in 1989. Voice activated tape recorder that he puts by this bird, Waldo. And where did they find Waldo again? Where's Waldo?
Waldo was in Jacques Renault's house.
That was Jacques Bird.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they have Jacques Bird, Waldo, who they got to because of, you know, the bird files or the pet files that they had in a previous episode. And Cooper sets this recorder by the bird in case, because it's a bird like a parrot or something that mimics human speech. And they're expecting it to speak at some point. Mm-hmm. And by the way, there's this great moment towards the beginning where Doc Hayward is talking about how to make the bird feel healthy again so it'll speak. And he's talking about feeding it, and he says,
"You got any apples?"
"Yeah, there's some in the bottom of the fridge."
"These grapes are right on the edge."
Why'd they keep that?
Just like that line.
It's great.
"Grapes are right on the edge." But yeah, so Cooper has this recorder just in case the bird speaks. And then the bird does start to speak. It says a few things. And then
Laura. And then it's like doing the voice of Laura Palmer.
Yeah. And then Leo shoots the bird from outside. Assassinates the bird.
The absolute truth. This is my favorite Hitman level, by the way. But the absolute the absolute tragedy of all the blood spilling on the pile of donuts broke my heart permanently.
Oh, yeah.
I was so sad to see that. There's, you know, violence with comedy. Twin Peaks loves to do that, right? It likes to pair those things together. Right before it's shot, when they're listening to the recording, you hear every time it was voice activated by accident. And so it'll be like Lucy going like, "Here, birdie, and like,
yeah,
playing with the bird and being cute with it. And then finally like, oh, God, this bird is mimicking Laura being assaulted the night of her death. Oh, yikes.
Yeah. And then it says like, "Leo, don't hurt. You're hurting me," yeah, or something like that.
Yep. Arthur's like, "Stop it, Leo." So we know Leo's was involved at least in some way. I wonder if the fan base watching this, I always like to think so much about like, what were they thinking? If they were just like, "That's it, dude, it's Leo. We did it. We solved Laura's murder. It's Leo Johnson." No, I wish.
This episode definitely is narrowing down the suspects to, by the end of this episode, the only plausible suspects you could have are like Leo Johnson, Dr. Jacoby, and maybe Ben Horn, just because he's like got his hands in so many shady things that it could be him. Or like, I don't know, Hank or something, because he's also not a great guy. But this episode really is putting a lot of suspicion, especially on Leo and on Jacoby.
Yes, 100%.
Yeah.
We're down to those two people. And to jump ahead again, we get to One-Eyed Jax. We got these costumes. Cooper has his suit and big Coke bottle glasses. Just big glasses.
That's Cooper's disguise. And then Big Ed's disguise is just a mustache.
And a mullet.
Yeah. Yeah.
The mullet point brings it all together. But of course, Cooper's like, "Hey, so we're all oral surgeons. Like, we're here for pleasure. We're on a day trip." And then they get there, and 5 minutes in, they meet Blackie O'Reilly. And yeah. Can you give me a clip of some of this dialogue here?
Yeah. So I didn't capture the whole exchange, but basically she's sizing them up. She says that Ed looks like a cop at one point, and Cooper's like, "I'm the cop."
Hilarious.
Which is some funny dramatic irony. And then she and Ed have this exchange.
"Fred, what's your line?"
"Own a gas station. I'm an oral surgeon."
"Oh, I got a Chevy parked out back with a serious root canal problem. You want to take a look?"
"Well, I was hoping you might need a little gum work, because I'd sure like to get a look under your hood."
"Fred's okay."
"Fred's a prince."
"So, boys, what's your pleasure?"
"Cards, dice.
For starters.
Casinos that way. This might just be your lucky night."
"Luck has nothing to do with it."
"It's not bad, not bad at all."
This is hilarious. This is so funny and also weird in exactly the way that I'm here for. And this is what like the Twin Peaks folksiness that I adore is like, we're in an illegal gambling like area. We're playing Western music. And a Big Ed forgot that he's supposed to be an oral surgeon. He broke his cover instantly and was like, I own a gas station. Yeah, I mean,
Big Ed also forgot that he's married and also in love with someone
else.
He's
in two serious relationships.
And he's just like, yeah, let me lay the moves down.
Didn't have to.
Quick.
Did not have to. Just wanted to. He has a great time with this. Basically, all that ends up happening with this plot in this episode is that they go to play cards and dice, and Cooper sees that it is indeed Jacques Renault, the man himself, who is dealing, and he confirms that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's where that plot line has a hard stop in this episode.
Yeah, because we're still, I think we're going to pick up right there in the last episode of the season. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I'm interested in. I remember it being pretty wackadoo, if you will.
Sure.
Yeah, you could say that. Yeah. But looping back around to investigation stuff, if you remember, last episode ended with Cooper going back to his hotel room after a long day, and Audrey Horne is there naked in his bed, and she's like, please don't make me leave, crying to him. This episode opens with her having that conversation with him. And if you didn't already think that Cooper was like a morally gray sort of guy, this scene just gives off the weirdest vibes.
Here's what Cooper says to Audrey in this scene.
What I want and what I need are two different things, Audrey. When a man joins the Bureau, he takes an oath to uphold certain values. Values that he's sworn to live by. This is wrong, Audrey. We both know it.
But don't you like me?
I like you very much. You're beautiful, intelligent, desirable. You're everything that a man wants in his life. But what you need right now, more than anything else, is a friend. Someone who'll listen.
Ugh.
It's a bummer because the theme song is so good. Like, you're comforted by that theme song. And then Cooper is just being kind of, he's towing the line. Like, I think what he's actually doing here, obviously, is he's setting the hard line and saying, no, we're not doing this. You're a teenager. I know you're 18 or whatever. She said she's 16 or 18.
She said she was 18 in the last episode.
Right. But he's just, it's playing in that soap opera space again, right? Where this would have totally just happened in the soap opera. Where he's like, he engages in this and it's controversial and he hides it from people and blah, blah, blah. But in Twin Peaks, he says, no, that's inappropriate. I don't want to do that.
Yeah. And there's good to what he's doing here. He's saying this is, that's wrong. But he's also saying, like, she's like, well, do you think, are you into me? And he's like, oh, yeah, totally. Totally. I'm so into you. For sure. Yeah. The only reason we're not fucking right now is because the FBI told me not to. But seriously, and it's like, why, Cooper? Why is that how you're answering the question? I don't know. It's just not, it's not nice to watch.
Yeah, and again, as we discussed in the first half, the background info showing you that they wanted this to be a thing, and Pecan McLaughlin was like, no, what is it? And made it not a thing.
Oh, but before we leave that scene, there's one final exchange between them that I think is worth thinking about, where they say this.
I can't tell you all my secrets.
Secrets are dangerous things, Audrey.
Do you have any?
No.
Laura had a lot of secrets.
Finding those out is my job.
So it's making clear this motif that they've started to talk about in previous episodes of just like secrets and the harmful effect of them. And that's a reality of the show overall, right? Everybody has a secret in Twin Peaks. And that's what kind of plays against the veneer of simple Americana, is that everybody's hiding something. And it raises the question of, what's Cooper hiding? He's gotta be hiding something.
Absolutely. But Audrey continues her investigation at the perfume department. She meets Jenny, who is a young woman who works there and is quickly recruited, like, overnight. I guess, like, Jenny's obviously been being canvassed for a while, but to us, it looks like it's been 5 minutes. And Audrey's great in the perfume store. She's very rude to customers, even though the guy who hired her is like, this is all customer relations. Don't be mean to them. She's like, you got it, dude. You got to hire me, though. And she's like, okay, I guess I'll hire you because your dad owns me. And she immediately is like, the woman is like, oh, I want it to pair well with something. And she, what's the line? She says, like, you should wear the perfume around your neck. Then you can show it off.
Right.
It's a conversation piece and it smells good. And the woman's like, you're an asshole. But the woman, the girl, Jenny, the other one who works there, is being recruited. And once again, Audrey has the magical power of sneaking behind walls and doors. She's like when you have a really high stealth score in a Bethesda game and you can just like stand 2 feet away from people and
you
hear
can just
everything.
Like wave at someone right in their face.
And they're like, huh? What was that noise?
The thing she says to get that guy away from the office is she's like, oh, I think a bus crashed outside.
Successful speech check.
He goes, ugh, okay, I guess I gotta go check it out.
Da, 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 da. And then she also takes a cigarette. She's like, yeah. I get a cigarette. He's recruiting this woman. He tells her, he gives the phone number of something called the Black Rose, some person, some place, whatever. It's the one at Jack's recruitment. Super gross. The whole, like, if you do well, you can be in hospitality. Like, tell me you're recruiting people for sex trafficking without doing it, without saying it. So yucky. And Audrey witnesses all of this from the comfort of a closet or whatever. And her first instinct is to get in on that. She calls the hotel, leaving messages for Cooper. She's trying to, like, tell him this and finds out through her investigating that he actually went there. And she says, okay, cool, I'm going to go there. If you didn't already think it's weird that we are sexualizing Sherilyn Fenn in this series, who is supposed to be playing an 18-year-old, her going to One-Eyed Jack's and not only giving a fake name, which I want to talk about, but like doing the classic like sexy girl ties a cherry stem with her tongue thing and getting hired for it, bananas. Certified bananas to me.
It's a question that I feel like we've phrased this way a lot, but... You know,
am I supposed to think this is gross?
Right. Like, are you commenting on this or are you doing it? Mm-hmm. When you show us Sherilyn Fenn tying a cherry stem with her tongue, are you commenting on the like depravity of this place? And is that saying something or is that titillation for the sake of television? Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that I have a clear answer to that question, but it definitely felt more like the latter than the former. But you could make a case for Audrey Horne is like, and I don't feel that I'm qualified to assess if this is what's happening or not, but the combination of her doing this, of her getting the job at the perfume counter by saying that she's going to say that the guy sexually assaulted her if he doesn't give her the job. Like, you could make a case that Audrey is sort of has agency over her sexuality across these episodes. But again, I don't really feel like I have the capacity to make that argument one way or the other. So I'm just sort of left feeling like I don't know about that scene, guys.
It's her wearing the outfit, too. And like, but you can make the argument. And like I said, neither of us is equipped, or you, like you said. Now, I just got you and me mixed up, which is so funny. neither of us are equipped to fully discuss this, but we're going to try, you know. And maybe there is something feminist to be said about like her, you know, whereas Laura is acknowledged. It was in her letters and diaries and voice messages acknowledging like, I have this weird power over people and I don't like that. I think that that's weird and unsavory. Audrey is embracing it and saying, I know that this works and I'm going to do it because it gives me the information I need and make people give me what I want when I do this and how they were raised differently. And you can get into all that sort of stuff here. But it is super weird. And then Blackie being this is why the fake names thing is funny to me. Cooper and Ed tell her that their names are Barney and Fred. Come on. First of all, come on. The fact that she says you look like a cop, I thought she was instantly going to be like, I know who you guys are. Like, that was just over. Come on. And then, but Audrey says, my name's Hester Prynne. And then, like,
oh my God, Audrey's so stupid. She's like, nobody's read this little indie book that I've read.
The Scarlet Letter. And then she says, I'm from this area in Montana or whatever. Blackie's like, oh, is the guy still there? And she's like, yeah, he's doing great. And she's like, that's the name of my dog. You're lying to me. I read the Scarlet Letter in high school. I guess if you're a high school, that's kind of in line. If you're a high schooler trying to betray people, you're like, I read this book. Let's see. I don't think anyone's going to remember the stupid Scarlet Letter.
I think it's very characterful that Audrey has this sort of audacity to go and do this undercover mission completely on her own, but just has not fully thought this through in all the ways that she needs to. That, you know, I think that works. And I do enjoy Audrey trying to take it upon herself to like solve the mystery, because mm-hmm. I think it unfolds that plot in a way that allows us to visit with different characters and get a different perspective on it. And it's just a little more engaging than if Cooper was solving all of this stuff himself.
Exactly.
But yeah, it is a pretty dumb choice to say I'm named Hester Prynne. And, you know, it's also calls to mind why that particular book, how does a book about a woman yeah. who's being marked for, you know, her sort of for being marked for committing adultery, right? Yeah. That's what the A stands for.
Yep.
What is that? How does that relate to Twin Peaks and the plots we see in the show? Like, it is kind of a surface level connection, but it's a fruitful one also.
Yeah. It's all there. I'm sure that Harley Payton and company wrote that name down and were like, slam dunk. And then they had to have a character be like, that's stupid. Why did you say that? Just to be realistic for a minute, you know? But everybody's investigating. And like you said, it's all different aspects of investigation. So Audrey's there, Cooper's there, and the Bookhouse Boys are all there. And then we can briefly touch on just Donna, James, in their own investigation with Maddie, who puts on a blonde wig and basically goes to this elaborate plot to convince Dr. Jacoby to leave his house and come to visit them. They want to talk to him about the tapes. Or they sneak into his house, right? That's what it is. They get him out of his house so they can break in and check the tapes.
Yeah. Essentially what they do is they dress Maddie up like Laura. They have her call Dr. Jacoby and impersonate Laura's tapes. The reason that they're doing that is because Laura had her tapes, but one of them, the one from the night that she died, is missing. And that's the tape that we've heard Dr. Jacoby play to himself.
Yeah.
In his room. And so they want to find that missing tape because they think maybe that'll incriminate Jacoby or something. They feel at this point like he's the one who killed her. They're convinced of it. So yeah, they dress Maddie up like Laura. Laura calls Jacoby. She's like, it's me, Doc. Come visit me, so they can get him out of his office and go and find the missing tape.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. I mostly like it because Donna has a cool hat in this scene.
Diane, it's 7:47 p.m. My cat's out from under the shoe rack, and time is a relative concept. After all, I had to wait around today for a Wi-Fi installation that was supposed to start between 11:30 and 1:30, and ended up starting at around 4, finishing at around 7. I don't think that this is what Einstein was talking about, but now that things have slowed down a little bit, I'm seeing the good side of relativity, too. Maybe I'll go stream the Olympics at 0.75 times speed just to really mess with my perceptions of reality. I'm thinking table tennis. Talk to you soon, Diane.
Diane, it's 2:36 p.m. I'm here in the middle of nature at nearly the highest point of mountain in Vermont. We took a chairlift most of the way up, and that was exciting, inspiring. At the summit, we're hoping to see a fire tower. Maybe take a photo, enjoy the silence. If you can't tell, Diane, the air here is a little bit thin, and I'm having trouble speaking long sentences. But it's worth it to really zoom out and think about distance, time, and how far we've come as a people, that we can really climb mountains. We'll talk soon.
Also, there's something to be said about, like, if I'm going to be serious for a minute, the power of not only Madeline Ferguson, but Cheryl Lee putting on a blonde wig. And obviously that just means like mess. I think they just messed up her actual hair and made it look like a wig. I don't think they put a blonde wig over her blonde hair.
Well, they might have put a blonde wig on top of her black wig. Hair wig.
Yeah, that's why maybe. It looked like an extreme mess. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's possible. So Laura Palmer is an icon at this point. She's literally a portrait. We've seen the prom portrait. We know who the story of the character is. It's reached a point in only, what, 6 episodes where we're already, like, creating a facsimile of Laura Palmer. We've made a new Laura. Right. Maddie is literally like, what if Laura came back and was alive again? That's the power of the scene when she tricks Jacoby. Is she says, here's today's newspaper. I'm alive. And I want to see you. And he, of course, he shouldn't believe that. He's a freaking psychologist. He has a PhD and an MD or whatever on his door. But he's like, oh, I'm still fascinated by this idea and I want to explore what this is and I want to know what's going on with this girl that I loved. I find there's something really thematically rich about that literally they got Maddie to play Laura and it works. And nobody questions it or says like, this is stupid, this isn't going to work. It pretty much works flawlessly. Because I think that Laura is becoming, more of a mythological figure. It's a concept of a person the further we get from the day of the murder itself.
Yeah. Well, I think there's what I found really engaging about that plot. It's similar to the Audrey plot where just as a TV viewer watching a procedural, it's much more entertaining to see an ensemble of characters converging towards the solution as opposed to like the one detective or the two detectives going around and gathering the clues, which those shows are great too when you're in the mood for them.
Yeah.
But this is a particular structure that we don't really see as much. But I think the other thing that's compelling about it is like what Audrey's choosing to investigate and the angle she's choosing to take versus the angle that James and Donna are taking are both very indicative of the way in which they are individually trying to process and understand Laura's death and Laura's life, and like how their lives intersected with her or with theirs. Because Audrey didn't really know Laura. She feels very distant from Laura. She has like a reverence and respect for her. And she also sees in Laura's story this really scary notion of like a teenage girl who was sort of like exposed to all of these adult things in a dangerous way before she should have been. And I think Audrey's kind of like trying to reflect herself in Laura's story and sort through that and figure that out. Whereas James and Donna are interested in a much more kind of like the simple hometown suburban girl who is Laura Palmer and like reconstructing that, but at the same time having to deal with this other Laura that they don't really understand. So
Donna and James are not ready to confront the bleakness that is Laura's actual past.
Yeah.
Right. There's a great clip that I think you have on your board of Laura in one of her messages to Jacoby talking about the way that men treat her. I don't know if you have that available.
Why is it so easy to make men like me? And I don't even have to try very hard. Maybe if it was harder.
James stops the tape before they hear what she says next.
Because he doesn't want to hear it. It's corrupting the image that he has of her, and he's losing that. And so is Donna. Donna's like, we were best friends, and yet I did. And I knew she had a pain in her, and that's what we're trying to look into, but I didn't know how deep it went, and now they're learning it. So it's basically like their story is one of a loss of innocence, I think.
Yeah. And like it kind of makes sense that they had to dress Maddie up to carry out their scheme, but you also see that they're getting something out of it too by resurrecting Laura. Like James looks at Maddie when she's dressed as Laura in a very loving way. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's as much a performance for Dr. Jacoby as it is a sort of like ritual for James and Donna. And Maddie's just kind of like, okay. Yeah. If you say so, I guess I will. Sure.
Yeah, she says to them at one point, like, I know that these two people had a connection to my cousin that I didn't, and I, you know, appreciated her and loved her, but I just want to make these people happy and help them out. Like, I want to... Maddie seems like a sincerely, like, attempting to be a good person.
Yes.
And just outside of the rest of the world. I actually legitimately thought at first, because I forgot where this plot goes, that Maddie was dressing up as Laura for James as, like, maybe a sick, like, memory thing. Where it's like, oh, I just want you to see her and see what that makes you feel and or whatever. It doesn't end up being that, but it's clearly that in his head when she comes by. You know, it's the same thing that Jacoby's about to have, or where he's like, oh, I thought this person wasn't alive. This person that mattered a lot to me is now here. It's kind of this is like what Lynch does so well. It's a profoundly scary thing that also feels weirdly mundane and dreamlike. Like, what if you just woke up tomorrow and somebody who's near and dear to you who died was back and walking around and was like, hey, what's up? You're like, the uncanny there, the surreal there, I think works really well.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, people talk this way and I've experiences too, that if somebody passes away, they might just show up in a dream and you wake up for a moment, like forgetting that they're not gone. Right. Mm-hmm. Like that's, I think, very much in the same space that you're talking about.
100%. It's very sad, but I've experienced it myself too. The last thing I have about this episode, because a lot of these plots are just picked up and then held in the air for the finale. We have some Hank continuing to suck stuff. I actually wrote in my notes that I think Hank is worse than James as an actor, but maybe it's as a character.
Oh. Mm.
Yeah, see, there's the trick.
Mm.
I like Hank in the story way less. I appreciate what James is doing, but I think the actor playing Hank is better.
Yeah, I think he's got more chops as an actor, and it's sort of like a with great power comes great responsibility kind of thing. Like he's just applying them haphazardly. But there are some moments where he really plays the kind of sociopathy of Hank in an effective way. I don't even know if that's a proper diagnosis, but he's manipulative. Let's say
very.
That.
Yeah, is there the scene where he like tells Norma or tells Shelley like, oh, I'm really glad like you helped out Norma when I was in jail or whatever. And,
yeah,
like,
and that guy helped out. What was his name? Peter. And Shelley's like, no, Ed, Big Ed. He's like, oh, yeah,
Big Ed.
Ed, right.
Now I know
I'm going to kill that guy.
100%, right. I thought that was funny in comparison to, like, I think it's basically the next scene where, is it Audrey who, like, betrays somebody or does trick somebody in a similar way? Oh, yeah, it's when Audrey's at the perfume counter. And the girl, Sarah, is like talking to her and she goes,
oh, sure.
Oh, I also got the number for Black Rose. I lost it, though. I'm so stupid. Do you have the number? And Sarah like looks at it for a second and goes, yeah, I do have the number for Black Rose. Yeah, here it is. Like just effortlessly lies. It takes side characters not knowing what's going on sometimes to push the main plot forward. I get that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, you have Hank stuff. The last things in my notes were just the mill plot. Well, it's time to talk about
the
mill.
There's
plot.
Also a lot of Leo Shelley Bobby stuff that we haven't talked about.
Oh, sure. Let's get into that. Yeah. Well, actually, I can do the mill stuff so quickly, right? So mill stuff. Josie gives a life insurance policy to Catherine saying if you die, then you're going to give all your money to me. Is that correct? Because it says like.
Yeah. Essentially, what happens is there's this insurance guy who shows up.
Mr. Neff.
Yeah, to talk to Catherine. And he says, hey, I just wanted to run this new life insurance policy by you since it takes effect tomorrow. And he clearly knows that, like, there's some people are going to kill her stuff going on here.
Yep.
And he's like, let me just run this by Catherine Martell and maybe she'll, you know, reward me for it or something. Because that's how the scene plays out. But you see that, yeah. What's happened is Josie has been named the sole beneficiary if Catherine dies. And we learn from the insurance guy that Ben Horn and Josie did all of that and said, oh, Catherine's just too busy, but here's her signature. And that doesn't seem like any insurance company would let that happen. That seems super, super shady. So Catherine now knows that Ben
and
has
Josie
betrayed
are
her.
Together.
Yeah, Ben and Josie are working together and they stole the ledger where she was keeping her books and their plan was to, we see Ben on the phone with Josie later and he says like, oh, make sure that Catherine's at the mill when we set it on fire or something.
Yeah.
Which again, like,
why would you just say that on the phone?
Like, why is that your plan, Ben? I guess now it makes more sense that he's on Josie's side because maybe Catherine, the mill plus Catherine's life insurance payout is the biggest payout for him or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but whatever.
Was that last episode, by the way, where the way that she gets his attention at the party is by spilling champagne on his nice shoes?
Yes, that was the last episode.
Legendary. Legendary.
Yeah.
Say what you will. The actress playing Catherine Martell, very good. Plotline,
she's good.
Pretty dumb. Leo and Shelley. So we briefly mentioned it last episode, but what happened was... Bobby is trying to convince Shelley, like, you got to get rid of Leo. If he ever messes with you, you have this gun. You got to do it. And he's like putting this thought into her head. And then at the end of last episode, he comes home after getting beat up by Hank for trying to run his own business. He comes in. He's all grumpy and shitty. And she's like, you'll never hurt me again. And she shoots him. And he just the weirdest scream in the world. She even says when recounting it later, she says he sounded like an animal dying. So I think they capture that really well. But he's fine. This is such a soap opera like cliffhanger thing of like, is Leo dead? He's like not even hurt. He doesn't even look injured. Because he comes up this episode and he just has a sniper rifle and he's ready to shoot Bobby.
Yeah, it really bugged me because, you know, that's a really important moment for Shelley's character to take that into her hands and then to process, okay, I did that. Like, how do I feel about the fact that I did that?
Yeah.
And it just really undermines it, I think, because they're like, oh, well, we need the bad guy. Like, we can't just kill the scary guy. He needs to be there in the next episode to be scary. Mm-hmm. But it just, I don't know. It cheapens that choice that Shelley makes, which is a huge, huge choice on her part, right? And, you know, there could have been a lot more to that and to her having to process like, well, you know, he was abusive to me and I killed him and now I'm free of him, but also I killed somebody. And that's like a, you know, that's pretty heavy and needs to be unpacked. But instead it's like, and I grazed his arm with the bullet and now I'm scared because he's out there. It just doesn't really change the dynamic that much. I don't know.
The episode doesn't have the time to get to linger on her, like thinking about that. Cause the way I was reading it was like, is she beat up that she shot him? Because like, just like Norma, she still feels some sort of attachment to this bad, bad person. Or is she beat up that he's alive? Like, where is the part that she feels emotionally torn up about? Because like, I think if he died, she would still have this regret, but it would be different. It would be less like fear. Because right now it's a combination of fear, like he's now going to come back and kill us, and fear that I didn't like finish the job or whatever. But also, yeah, she shot a person that she's married to.
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, I'll reiterate again, like I don't think I'm the person to really fully understand how a story like this should be told. But just feels like they're missing opportunities or like putting the emphasis in the wrong place here. But I do like the sort of like Bonnie and Clyde thing that Bobby and Shelley are doing where they're like, okay, we're going to, starting in the previous episode where it's like, okay, we're going to, you know, put the frame on Leo. And they're doing this whole thing where Bobby's like, yeah, when he walks in, I'm going to hold up the gun and be like, Leo, do the dishes or I'm going to shoot you or whatever. It's like, no, you're not.
No, you're not.
You're not going to do that, Bobby. You're not that tough. And then that great interaction where Shelley's talking to Andy and she basically convinces or plants the seed in Andy's head about Leo being guilty. And then Bobby just shows up in the James Donna Maddie plot to plant cocaine in James's motorcycle.
Yeah, sure.
So there's this very elaborate scheme that both of them are at the head of, which is kind of fun to watch them do.
Yeah. I reiterate, I find Shelley and Bobby both to be immensely attractive, and it frustrates me because I want the best for them. But I know, well, okay, let's see where their plot goes. Let's put more pins. Do we have enough pins on this freaking corkboard of Twin Peaks plot lines? Who can say? We're getting to the end of the season. Last brief note, not really relevant scene to anything else. Nadine is watching Invitation to Love. If you remember, Chet got his money swindled out of him. If you're following the Invitation to Love plot line, it's pretty good. he gets beat up by this guy, Montana. And then in this episode, he shoots Montana in the face and everyone freaks out. And that's like the dramatic gunshot that ends the episode. Nadine is eating bonbons like an absolute icon. Who can relate? Ed comes up to her and he's so nice here. And it's still frustrating to me that Ed is nice, but I get it. She's like, I took the Drape Runners to the patent office and they were rejected. I'm sad. I'm miserable. I'm eating these bonbons. One, there's kind of a stereotype of like women being depressed and eating that I don't love. This is the same episode where Ben and Jerry are. Majan, I just had a realization.
That they're eating ice cream.
And they're Ben and Jerry. Fuck.
Yeah.
Fuck. Dog, I didn't realize that when I'm watching the episode. My eyes just popped open like I just saw
they
God.
Are tossing back ice cream.
Ben and Jerry are eating.
Ben's holding like a double pint. What is that? A quart? I don't know what size
it is. It's big. It's really big.
Yeah.
Jerry's like, it needs more whatever pecans. And so, yeah, again, just food while people emotionally cope is all I wanted to say. And Ed trying to comfort her. But I can't get over the fact that he's wearing a bolo tie. His disguise involves him wearing a stupid, like, Texas bolo tie. It sucks. Anyways, that's what I got. I think I hit every single scene that I wanted to talk about. I'm happy about it. We're going to go see what happens to One-Eyed Jax. We're going to see what happens with Jacoby. James is going to get caught with cocaine, maybe. And rest in peace to my favorite bird, Waldo.
Yeah, the only thing we didn't talk about that was important to me was an update on my favorite plot of the series, which is the Andy Lucy story.
Oh my God, bless.
Lucy's back.
Lucy.
And there's this exchange.
Good morning, Officer Brennan.
I sure wish you would stop calling me Officer Brennan.
Officer Andy, this is peak activity time at the station switchboard. So it's really not convenient for me to talk right now. Twin Peaks Sheriff Station, may I help you? One moment, please.
That call is from some kind of doctor, so we'll learn more about that in a future episode, but that seems to be the root of why Lucy has been cold to Andy lately. And that's the plot I care about.
Pin it. I wonder if someone could actually track how many pins how many times I've sent people are going to pin this plot line on the podcast. That's what we got. Any stray notes, Magellan?
Nope. I don't think so.
Delicious. Well, folks, we hope you enjoyed this excellent discussion of Twin Peaks. Was it excellent? I don't even know. You tell me. Magellan, can you also tell me what we're watching next time on Peaks Chats?
Next time on Peaks Chats, we are watching the final episode of season one of Twin Peaks, which is called The Last Evening. Audrey is hired at One-Eyed Jax, but is caught. Well,
nope. You don't want to read it?
Yeah, this is all spoilers. This is just going to tell you what happens. Let's not do that. Stuff happens. The season ends. We'll talk about it next week.
Perfect. Love it. Stuff happens. The season ends. We could use that for every season finale description.
Yeah.
Cool. Magellan, let's take it to the zone of plugs. I'm going to do it this time. I feel like I've made
Please
you do
it.
Please
do. Yes. Do it.
Here we go. If you would like to get a hold of us, please send us emails at chatspod@gmail.com. That is all instances of chatspod spelled chatspod. We're on Twitter at chatspod, or you can follow us for updates about the show. We have a community-run subreddit, which is at r/chatspod on Reddit. And we would appreciate it if you did a couple of things. Number one, if you haven't already, please give us a rate on your podcast platform of choice. That means Apple Podcasts. We're on Spotify. We're on Stitcher. We're on everything you can think of. And if we're not, tell us so we can fix that. Also, consider supporting us with some coinage over at Patreon. Patreon.com/chatspod is where you can give us your coins. And we love your coins. And if you give us $5 in coins every month, then we will thank you here. Thank you to our $5 patrons. Kat, Marcus, Nick, Pat, Fendon, Ryan, Six, and Stefan. Thank you for supporting Chats, the television podcast, and keeping the lights on. We got all sorts of bonus content on there. We highly recommend you check things out over there. And if you want the number one source for all things Chats, chatspod.com is a website that we did make that has a lot of fun Easter eggs and links to everything we've discussed today. It's awesome. And if you like our podcast logo, it's done by our friend Camilla, who was on the last pod, two podcasts ago, excuse me. And she can be found at all social media platforms at Camilla Strader. That's CamillaStrator. Camilla Illustrator. You got this, guys. It's a portmanteau. I believe in you. And it'll be in the show notes, too.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Magellan, we like to end the podcast by doing what's called chat sounds, where instead of personal plugs, we recommend things for people to do in the meantime after listening to 17,000 hours of Peak Chats.
Okay.
Before the next 17 hours of Peak Chats. So what, Magellan, my friend, is your chat sound for this week? I haven't breathed in the past 5 minutes.
I really don't know what my chat sound is.
Curtis Connor. I'll kill you.
Yeah, I have been recommending a lot of YouTube chatsums lately, and that's been the sort of primary things that I've been consuming. But this past week, I shifted back to listening to more podcasts, and listen to podcasts. You get to rest your eyes. You get to do other stuff, do some chores, walk around. It's great.
They're literally listening to one right now.
I know, but I rediscovered why I like podcasts and what's special about podcasts in contrast with watching a video. So I'm going to say get back into podcasts.
Can I have one recommend that you haven't given before?
No.
Okay. Thank you for indulging me.
I'm recommending the experience of listening to podcasts.
I'm going to write that in the document, the experience of listening to podcasts. Great. I have an artist to recommend for folks. So if you keep up with the electronic music community, you must have heard earlier this year of the tragic death of one Sophie, who is an incredible producer. At the young age of 34, passed away tragically. She was incredibly influential and has been featured and produced some of the best pop songs of the last like 6 or 7 years. Really, really creative stuff. There's actually a playlist on Spotify that I'm really depressed that I didn't find before her passing, but it's every Sophie produced song on this damn site. And because she only had like at 2 EPs under her own name, this is a, you know, obviously a mononym that she goes by, it's kind of hard to find her stuff without looking into song credits. So somebody basically gathered it all together. And I mean, she's worked with Vince Staples on some of his best songs. She has worked a lot with Charlie XCX. She's a big reason Charlie XCX blew up. She's worked with Madonna and Nicki Minaj, and just incredibly, incredibly talented, a very unique, distinct style. And if you listen to a lot of her work, you'll start to hear it kind of go throughout all of her work. It always bumps me out when I get into somebody after their passing, but we move on, we press onward, and we try to take their influence and what they did and learn from it, right? Mm-hmm. So definitely check out Sophie. You can literally look up Sophie music producer and find all of her stuff out there. It's mm-hmm. Strange, creative, loud, and just really special. Honestly, I've had a great time listening to all of her work in the past couple days. But that's what I have, sir. So thank you, as always, for being the rock to my hard place. Thank you for being the Truman to my Cooper. That's my new one. And thank you all for listening to this episode of Peaks Chats. Damn good pod. Damn good. Okay, everybody, welcome to Spoiler Zone. What's going on? Remember when, the Spoiler Zone really shouldn't just be remember when thing happens, but remember when Maddie dies in a brutal way?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the sort of like completion of what's starting here of people putting her into being this reenactment of Laura Palmer, right?
Yeah, exactly. Leland sees her when she goes out that night. There's a brief shot where he's like standing, he's awake at night in the living room.
Yeah.
So that stuff bums me out. That's why when I was like, Maddie's plot doesn't go anywhere, I didn't want to be like, it goes into the ground, sadly. Mm-hmm. Again, really trying to emphasize to the people who haven't watched the show before that like if the One-Eyed Jack stuff and like the Mill stuff, you got to get used to it, guys. That's going to be the show for a while, and it's okay. You're going to learn to like it. This is all we're going to have for so... I'm not crying. You're crying. No, honestly, it gets interesting. I mean, like, the Mill stuff, once they add new characters, it gets cool. I just think that they're running out of momentum with who we have right now. Like, there's only so many times that you can be like, is Ben betraying Josie? Is Josie betraying Ben? Is she smoking a cigarette in the room by herself? What's going on? Do you remember that Jerry is in Twin Peaks The Return, Magellan?
What?
Jerry Horn is in Twin Peaks The Return.
He is?
It's so good, dude. Don't even read about it. Don't look anything up about it. I know we don't talk about return spoilers, so that technically is breaking my rule, but he's in it. It's great. As Jerry Horn, too. It's not even like the actor playing a different guy. Like, Jerry Horn is in Twin Peaks The Return. Oh, it's so good. I was reading about tulpas earlier. Again, don't look that up. Don't Google it, anybody. But it's exciting. I wanted to talk more with Michelle about like what he thinks about that whole 18-hour movie thing, because that was like a discourse for a while. It was like, is Twin Peaks The Return an 18-hour movie or is it 18 episodes of TV? Because it came out weekly. Only the first like 2 aired in a movie theater, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm of the opinion that it just, at this point, what is a movie or a TV anyway? Like, why call a TV a movie when we can just call them both like the same thing? I don't know. We'll talk about it. I think it's because certainly The Return is doing a much more filmic thing, or it's definitely different than Twin Peaks, right?
Yes, big time.
But we'll talk about it. Also, you know, it's interesting the like way that gambling shows up in The Return and like Las Vegas.
Oh, I didn't catch that. Good job.
Yeah, I watched a couple episodes.
Yeah. We can't do a return cast just yet, but I'm excited.
Hello.
Hello. Yep, you'll get that, guys. You're going to get there. We just need to get through 22 episodes. So other thing, the Log Lady stuff, we can get a little bit more explicit with this. It's not as interesting.
Do you want me to play the Log Lady's clip here?
Yeah, go for it.
Here's what her log says.
Shh. I'll do the talking. Dark. Laughing. The owls were flying. Many things were blocked. Laughing. Two men. Two girls. Flashlights passed by in the woods over the ridge. The owls were near. The dark was pressing in on her. Quiet then. Later, footsteps. One man passed by. Screams. Far away. Terrible. Terrible. One voice.
Man or girl?
Girl. Further up, over the ridge, the owls were silent.
That's what I was kind of trying to get at when we were talking with the Log Lady before, and I was saying that sometimes the things she says are not actually that deep.
Yeah, it's not the dream sequence. The dream sequence is you can absolutely like pull apart and get useful plot. It's not always the case with the Log Lady. Do you know what her deal is, Magellan? Do you remember why she's the way she is?
Doesn't it have to do with her husband dying?
Her husband's spirit is in the log.
Yeah. When did we learn that?
I think in this episode, should they talk about her husband? I don't know if
they
specifically
talk
said
about
he's
the husband
in the
log. This one. Said he was a logger.
Yep. Not a fireman, but yeah, like a logging guy. That type of character is relevant later, whatever that job was, the axe man. It's involved with the UFO stuff and back in the day, and she was like taken over by aliens or something, and they like messed up her brain as a kid, and you know. Her wiki page, her Twin Peaks wiki page, if you want to just like spoil a lot of stuff with you for yourself, is really sad. She was like friends with Jacoby for a while, but then when she like started to lose her, you know, if you want to call it her sanity, whatever the appropriate way to refer to it is, he like distanced himself from her, further showing us that he sucks big time.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like there was a whole generation of people at Twin Peaks High School before the current generation, and she's part of that also. But also she's like, she has like a Black Lodge tattoo on the back of one of her legs. It's like, yeah, there's Log Lady lore. Nothing particular. She does mention owls though. Famous line from season.
What are the owls?
They're not what they seem, Magellan. Okay. Yeah, but what does that mean? The owls become a bigger thing in season two. Owls hold spirits. You can put spirits in an owl. That's all that is.
Oh, okay. Hey, you put spirit in an owl.
Yeah, Bob has straight up. I think Mike's been in an owl. They like put spirits, literally. Just they're vessels for spirits.
Oh, okay. We talk about at all when James and Donna go to look at the spot where the half of the heart locket was buried? There's an owl watching them.
We didn't talk about that. Good catch.
Well, there was an owl watching them.
Whose spirit do you think that was then?
Probably, I don't know.
Bob.
Or Laura's spirit.
Oh, that's kind of nice. I like that. We didn't talk much about Flesh World, but it's like the center of a lot of the grossest stuff about the show. It's just so funny to me. I know we said this, but Flesh World being a legal business where it's like you said.
There's more of Flesh World stuff?
Not much. Not to the point. I'm only bringing it up here because I didn't. It's this is also like where we can.
Oh, okay.
Just the refuse from the episode. But
yeah,
Flesh World's dumb. I do love Andy saying Renault instead of Renault. I know that the Jacques Renault plot doesn't go anywhere. I think that's all I got.
Yeah, there's not really.
Oh, James is going to look for his mom.
Oh, that's why he goes out on his motorcycle journey, right?
Believe that's correct. And then he like is with an older woman. Oh, yeah. The James stuff is so stupid. Oh, God. Do you know that Nadine gets with Mike?
With Who?
Mike, Bobby's friend, Mike.
What?
She like has a, this is season two.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I just flashed to the part of season two where Nadine thinks she's a teenager.
Yeah, fuck yeah, dude. It's kinda,
holy
shit,
I forgot about that.
Stop telling me season two is bad, folks. Nadine like has brain damage at some point and thinks she's a teenage girl.
God,
and she wears like sweaters and like dates Mike.
And she's like, oh, hey, Ed.
Yeah.
He doesn't know that they're married. God.
Oh, yeah. And he's like, finally, I can be with Norma. Oh, it sucks, actually.
Oh, my God. That's terrible.
I'm thrilled. So glad.
So does the mill burns in the next episode, right?
Is that true?
Doesn't it? Doesn't season one end with the mill burning down?
I believe you. Yeah.
I think that's right.
And then Catherine's there and Catherine dies, but she doesn't die because she comes back as Mr. Tajimura, the most racist thing. I love how many things you forgot about season two, dude. I'm thrilled.
Oh,
Mr. Tajimura, criminy. Where she wears an Asian like face with like a fucking
yeah,
Fu Manchu.
She has yellow face. Yeah.
Oh, it's racist, guys. Boy. I'm just going to keep using a spoiler segment to remind Magellan of how stupid this shit is. And those of you who haven't seen it yet, strap in. You shouldn't be listening to the segment anyways. That was cathartic for me, Magellan. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Oh, God. There's so much.
There's so much.
Bad in season two.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like a lot of that stuff is actually concentrated in a smaller patch of episodes than we think.
The like second to last episode is the Miss Twin Peaks pageant. It goes, dude.
Oh, man. Okay.
Dick Tremaine.
Yeah.
Okay. Audrey has a boyfriend.
Yeah.
Donna has like a boyfriend, I think. Everyone just gets boyfriends. Billy Zane is in the show.
All right. I guess it gets kind of dumb.
Should we? Don't watch it. No, do watch it. It's entertaining. We're going to instead watch, what the hell is the show called?
On the Air.
We're going to watch On the Air instead of season two. And then we're going to skip to season three. Good plan. Yeah. All right, Magellan, I'll talk to you next week.
Okay. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Toot toot.